Funding for the Think Podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu. Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are you jealous? And if you are, is that something you should be ashamed of? We've all had the sense that we were in jeopardy of losing something or someone that we valued. Jealousy feels so awful that we will go to great lengths to relieve it, and that may be its greatest benefit to us, making us more attentive lovers, more diligent workers. Peter Tuohy joins us to talk about this. He's professor of classics in the Department of Greek and Roman Studies at the University of Calgary. His new book is called Jealousy. Peter, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Pleasure to be here.
How did you start thinking that jealousy might be more than just a destructive emotional force?
I was working on the Boredom book, really, which is the one that preceded this, which you did speak to me about. And emotions, it came to me again and again and again as I read about on the topic. There's nothing harmful or bad in emotions. There's nothing wrong with feeling bored. There's nothing wrong with feeling angry, I suppose, in the same sort of way. It's what you do with it that's the bad thing. So anger can be useful if you're trying to protect your children, for example, protect your own household. But if it gets too strong, then it becomes toxic. So it is with boredom, and it struck me, well, jealousy's got to be pretty much the same sort of way. It's easy to see how it works. It works to our advantage, and it's blindingly obvious how it can work to our disadvantage, isn't it?
And it does feel really unbearable when we're in the throes of a particular, moment of jealousy.
That's the case. I think just reading the descriptions of it is painful reading. I don't think there's a person on the planet who's been immune to jealousy, so that it's easy to empathize with it. It introduces the sort of confusion that exists when you try and describe what jealousy is, because people want to say, it's the feeling, it's this pain I'm feeling, that's what jealousy is. Well, that's the pain, isn't it? And, you might have had your finger trodden on, and that could be painful too. So for trying to define it, I think you have to get away from the notion of pain. But yes, it's an intensely painful experience.
How important is the distinction between jealousy, in which we fear we might lose something that we can't bear to part with, or envy, in which we covet something that belongs to somebody else?
I think that's a definition sort of beloved to people like me, that is to say boffins, people who work in universities. It works a lot better in theory than it does in practice, but it's a great way to start. And if it's easy to think of examples where the two intersect. For example, there's one house in a neighborhood and two different people would like to buy it. So envy and jealousy are triangulated emotions, three people or two people and a thing, so that the two people are after the house, but there's only one really good house. Now, your neighbour gets it. You may envy him his good fortune of having that house, but you may also feel a sense of loss because now he's got it and you're not going to get it. And that by the definition we've just been talking about, that sense of loss is jealousy. So is it envy? Is it jealousy? It's easy to see how this sort of thing can spill over into human relations, into love relations and so on. So I think the words blur so much, and we use them really. We use them interchangeably in ordinary speech, and you've got to respect that, don't you? The way I would use envy and jealousy is envy is a sort of a slightly weaker version of jealousy. If you're talking to somebody, if I were to say to you, "I envy you your job," you'd say, "Well, that's okay. Tough to be you," but if I said I'm jealous of your job, you'd say, why have we got this man on the show?
I think it is good. I appreciate that you are willing to sort of allow us to conflate these because they do go together, and it becomes in some ways, I mean, you can argue about how important the semantic distinction is between the two when they're so often hard to completely tease out from one another.
Hmm. Yes. No, and I think is from the little I can see of other languages, they often lack the distinction. So it's always contextual that they're relying on. So I think you've got to be pretty suspicious of academics who are insisting on the distinction between the two experiences. We live in a, you know, in another world, as it were, often unsullied by these emotions. It's not the case. Academics are the most jealous species known to the planet. And I love them all dearly. But anyway.
Well, the classic picture of jealousy involves romantic relationships, sexual jealousy, and we are going to talk about that. But what's fascinating is that this begins really early in life. It can be documented in infancy, and certainly we're well familiar with sibling rivalry.
Yes, it's why it exists, I suppose, is because once again, you've got a triangulated sort of a situation, and jealousy needs that. So you might have the mother and a friend and the baby, or two children and a parent, or the children as a group and the mother and father. So the child is jockeying for the attention of the parent. We understand that, but I suppose there's a sort of evolutionary imperative behind that. You've got to make sure that these people who are going to look after your life and limb for the first, you know, however many years of your life it is in whatever culture you come from, your first 15 or so, that they're giving you that the attention you need. So I guess the very small child is pushing for this attention, and we'd call it jealousy by definition, but it's a beneficial thing for it. You're not going to get forgotten this way and left unchanged or unfed. So that's the beginnings of it, I think.
And I suppose to feel jealous also, it typically requires that we're at least tangentially aware of the intentions of other people. It's a social emotion, right? It requires kind of other people to exist.
Yes, I think so. Though I'm told often by my students that the distinction between social and or primary and secondary is starting to blur a little bit as they see more and more of these things in animals. But you're right, though jealousy is often so much a misinterpretation of other people's intentions and attitudes, isn't it? That somebody mightn't be sweet on your husband or your wife. They may be completely innocent, and you're completely misinterpreting it. Hmm. So, in that sense, jealousy's built on doubt, is it not? And being suspicious and so on.
Yeah, that's interesting. We can certainly see that because this is someone that we love and prize so much that they seem important to us. I even think about the kind of outsized parental fears that their children will be kidnapped. And I think the reason that we struggle with that is that you think your child is so perfect that everyone in the world must want them and would wish to possess them if they could.
Yes, that makes sense to me. That's how I felt with the children, I think. Still do a little bit. I guess, too, it's hardwired into us to protect our own small children. And even if we can't enunciate this sense of how perfect they are, our bond to them is so strong that we're naturally suspicious of other creatures shining up to them. Who knows what they're going to perform?
How does professional jealousy spur us to perform better in the workplace?
I guess it begins to blur into envy here, doesn't it? Mm. That if envy is based on gain, and if jealousy is somehow or other linked to that, because we're not trying to distinguish them absolutely closely, in the simplest of ways, it drives you on to compete with other people. This is in the very simplest of ways, isn't it? You want what the other person has. So that we've still got the triangle, don't we? That is to say, it's probably a thing or a possession or position, and two people jockeying for it in some way or another. That's not a bad thing, is it? That's competition. It's what the world runs on, whether you like something like capitalism or not. People will compete. It can become not quite toxic, but it seems to play a much more prominent role in certain types of pursuits than others, doesn't it? Perhaps in finance and perhaps in creative endeavors, it seems to be particularly strong.
Yeah, and I guess it has to be sensitively managed, right, in order to not be too toxic. On the one hand, you want people to continue to do their best work because they don't want to be, you know, shown up. On the other hand, if you make people too frightened that they're going to lose their status or their position, they stop taking any kinds of risks.
This sort of thing has been, well, it seems to appear in the literature, the people who work on this sort of thing, that an atmosphere that encourages too much of too much jealous competition amongst workers, people will step back and perform at a lesser level than they might if it's not managed properly. That's the downside of it, isn't it? And it's the unexpected downside of jealousy in the workplace, of a sort of a willed apathy by the us work slaves.
So tell us a little bit about jealousy in the world of academia, because my understanding is there is a lot of being aware of what everyone around you has achieved and accomplished, and you don't want to appear to be bragging about yourself, but you do want to make sure that everybody around you knows exactly what you've done.
Yes. It's if I say too much, I won't be able to leave the studio afterwards, will I?
I can't guarantee your safety after the hour is up.
I'm on my own. I think wasn't it Henry Kissinger who said that whatever it is, the emotions run so high because the stakes are so low, something like that, which maybe is why he got out of it. I don't know, but it's I suppose because it's such a public profession insofar as people put it on the line through their publications all the time, and they're constantly judging one another. Not only are they right, but are they better than me? Are they going to get the advancement that I mightn't get? It spills over into so many other areas too, I think. I started my career in Australia, and it was a little more relaxed in those days, and perhaps still is, but I feel in North America, because of things like ratemyprofessors.com and our annual assessments, your very breathing is rated by somebody or other, and that produces a type of paranoia and a constant looking over the shoulder at your colleagues, which encourages a type of a jealousy, an envy. If somebody is doing better than you, you want to do better than them, and so on. So does that make any sense?
It does. We're going to come back to this conversation in a moment. The subject is jealousy. That's also the title of Peter Tuohy's new book. He's professor of classics in the Department of Greek and Roman Studies at the University of Calgary. We'd love to have you weigh in on this as well. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet @ChrisBoydThink.
Thank you. Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults from fine arts to history to financial planning. Spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Peter Tuohy. He is professor of classics in the Department of Greek and Roman Studies at the University of Calgary and author of a new book called Jealousy. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Peter, I was thinking about this. There are the seven deadly sins, right, which don't seem to guide people's behavior in quite the same way they did in the Middle Ages, but we still know what they are. We can pretty easily admit to most of the others: wrath, greed, sloth, pride, lust, gluttony, in maybe a self-deprecating way. We can admit to feeling those emotions, but most people would be hard-pressed to openly admit feeling envious or jealous of someone else.
It's true, isn't it? I think you can just about admit envy, just about in the way the word's usually used. But jealousy, no, never. And I think one of the hopes I had in the book was to free the emotion up a little bit. At least one voice saying, "Well, maybe we'd be better if we could admit to it, because well, it's often quite a useful sort of thing. We all feel it." I hope mostly not too badly, but many people very badly periodically, and it'd be better to be out in the open with it. But whatever it is, it remains one of those emotions that are behind the doors. I think, you know, seriously, loneliness is another one. Who's ever willing to admit they're lonely? You will, but only with your closest of friends, or on a survey. And jealousy's just the same sort of thing.
I suppose because we want to seem like we are too confident in ourselves and particularly when we talk about jealousy of a partner, we want to seem like we have no doubts that they would ever want to be with anyone except us.
That's right. And if they are with somebody or other else, we'd like to feel ourselves so proud that we can say, well, you want to do this, walk away, and I will too. That's it's a strange attitude that's inculcated into us. It's not something that anybody ever easily plays out, that, and nor should they. But I guess it is a matter of pride as well, isn't it? That, yes, I can cope. I don't feel these emotions. I believed when I wrote On Boredom that everybody felt the same way about boredom, but to my surprise, nobody's embarrassed about it at all. Just jealousy.
So the way that jealousy affects, and let's you know, be clear here that as we talk about this, we can acknowledge that sometimes jealousy is part of really dysfunctional relationships that turn violent. That's not what we're talking about in this context. When jealousy is just sort of beyond and turns into a control thing, but a milder form of jealousy can help us to sort of pay a little more attention to the object of our affections.
Yes, indeed, and it's hard to admit to when you're the person perhaps feeling the unease, the twinges, the beginnings of jealousy, that maybe it's as much your fault as anybody else's. But yes, indeed, if your partner is perhaps not straying, but you feel that something like this might be happening, well, maybe the emotion is telling you should take a good look at yourself and perhaps decide whether you've contributed to this before you go closing any doors. As you say, there's extreme cases where you have to, I suppose, count your losses. But in these sort of complicated, you know, dual relationships, it's telling you to be careful, is it not, and to look at yourself. So in that sense, it can be a very useful and salutary emotion, can't it?
And on the other end of this, if we know that our partner is just a little bit jealous, that's kind of a reaffirmation that they value us.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Provided they don't overdo it, then it becomes destructive. But yes, feeling that their emotion is going to perhaps pull you together again. I guess this is news to, in a sense, to no one, but it's news in the sense that we don't like to talk about it very much. Mm. It's you'd never admit to your friends, well, I've been in this situation and, you know, I was feeling pretty bad. you're just not going to say it because it makes you look weak. Mm. And I think particularly for men where there's the image of the cuckold there, what man wants to feel that he cannot manage his beloved, his wife, his partner. In that sense, it's harder for men. I think if you look on past the in Shakespeare, in Othello, when he talks about it, he talks first about the cuckold and says it's okay for the cuckold. It doesn't worry him at all because he knows what his partner, his wife's up to. It's the person who doubts that has the problems. And I thought, boy, Shakespeare, you've got it wrong there, mate. It's not like that at all. A cuckold feels just as bad. Knowledge doesn't actually help. I'm straying a little, but that always comes to mind. Then I think, why did he sell us so short on that? But he does.
Is our present understanding of how jealousy is that reflected pretty much in the same way in art and literature going back hundreds of years?
I think it really does vary because of the probably the simplest of ways to think of it is that in societies where arranged marriage is the norm, the sort of the peak period of jealousy when romantic love is at its strongest in a relationship is removed in most cases, that the couple may not know one another very well and may not be that terribly fond of one another for the first some years of their marriages. So in a case like that, this jealousy seems to be more underreported. And there, I guess, I'm thinking of the Greek and Roman literature that I earn my living with. Why is it less common? And I really believe that it's linked to the absence of choice in marriage, which emerges later in the ancient world, and then you start to see a jealousy that we understand starting to bubble up as young people are the same age, they're choosing one another as partners. So I think, and how would you describe it from what I'm saying? You'd say jealousy's always there. Potentially it's a universal, and there are good evolutionary and biological reasons for that, but some societies need it more than others. So it's probably not the small village society where everybody looks at one another. It's probably in those societies where choice is at a premium. Hmm. So really, a place like North America, for example, where choice we take as a right or as an aspiration that we're put in the position to have it. So in cases like this, there just seems to be a funny sort of a correlation because you're choosing your partner and because romantic love is so involved in that. In that choice, the attraction, a rejection of it is always possible and is going to cause jealousy to brew up where you're not choosing, where your parents are making the choice for you, and goodness knows they may choose better than you would. The relationship may be more pacific and less inclined to jealousy. Ancient Roman marriages seem to me, from what I can see of them, to have been actually very happy, effective unions, in spite of the fact that they are arranged.
Because people came to them expecting a business proposition first, and sort of any kind of emotional gains were just a fringe benefit?
I think so, yes. And there are things that build up over years. If the marriage was lucky enough to survive, divorce was high amongst them, amongst the elite. But you'd think as much for family reasons as personal reasons. But if a marriage lasts, then strong emotional bonds seem to build up between them. But these are the bonds that people who've been married many, many years often report. In our society as well. But it seems at that point in a relationship, people are less troubled by jealousy anyway. And I think particularly if they don't go in with those expectations. I'm not urging a return to arranged marriage here. Just don't shoot the messenger. I'm just telling it as it seems to me. So we're back to that position that sexual jealousy is probably it's bound to be a universal, but it's not always as necessary in some societies as it is in others. And I think the correlative to that is if you can see what appears to be jealousy in animals, whether it's sexual or the other type that we've been talking about work, it suggests a continuum, doesn't it? That if animals have got it, well, they've had it always. And are we so arrogant that we'd say, no, we haven't? It was suddenly discovered in the Enlightenment or some period like that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now to Steve in Allen. Hello, Steve.
Hey, how are you?
Very well.
Hey, this is an interesting topic. I know that, and please forgive me if I'm wrong, there was an apple that Paris had to present to the three goddesses, and only one could have, which was, I think, between Athena, Hera, and Aphrodite. And there was that jealous tension there, and which led to the Trojan War. Are there examples of how jealousy is more moderated in classical literature?
I think there's not so much examples of how it's moderated as there's more of a silence on the issue. Where jealousy seems to occur, it's in relationships between, not between potential suitors so much as between people who are courting, let us say, courtesans, as we'd say, not quite prostitutes, but something like it. That's where you're more likely to see this. Well, there it's much less serious. It's not relationship-threatening because these are not long-term relationships anyway. So it's the silence, I think, from cultures like Greco-Roman antiquity that's that indicates more than actual moderation of the emotion.
Sigmund Freud was really hung up on jealousy.
Yes, he was, wasn't he? This is the Oedipus complex you're referring to,
right?
That's so much a part of, particularly North American culture, isn't it? Because of the whole Freudian period of, I guess, from the post-war era, really, up until until Freud was more or less unceremoniously dumped in the early 80s by it was the DSM Diagnostic and Statistic Manual number 3. I hope I've got those details right.
But, well, what's fascinating is that, yeah, he was disproven in the Oedipal theory, but people are still still interested in that.
Yes, I think it's not so much disproven as totally ignored, and I don't mean that in any judgmental way. That I talk to people here in neurology, and they'll say, "Tell me about this Freud guy." And, I think it's, and often there's a person in psychology who works in the history of psychology, particularly, will turn on them and say, "Really, you know where the hippocampus is, and you don't know about Freud." But I think it's the lack of, in Freud's case, it's the lack of evidence, of figures, of the sorts of experiments that can be replicated that you expect in science. That's why he's ignored. These are a poet's hunches rather than truths, and they have the truth of poetry, which is starting to get me towards an answer to your question. The Oedipus complex and the fraught sort of family relationships that children have with their parents, they're real and they're very powerful. Freud wanted it to be sexual, but I think we'd ignore that now and say, well, they're still just as strong, the tensions between a father and a son or a daughter and the mother. And you'd say, well, how do you know this? Well, Alice Sebold's book, The Almost Moon, which I think is a particularly good book. People run it down. I don't know why, but it's about the relationship between a mother and a daughter. The mother sort of squashing the daughter's a sense of self-importance, the importance, the value of her own looks and personality. And the daughter looks after her mother very carefully until at one point she snaps and she, in her old age, in her dotage, she suffocates her and sticks her in the basement freezer, which is a terrible thing to do.
Yes.
There's a little bit of black humour in that book for sure. But what's at the root of a problem like that? As Freud would have said, well, I used to believe in the Electra complex. She was Oedipus' sister and mixed up in the killing of the mother. And he would have said, well, I used to believe in it, but it sounds like the Electra complex to me. So the poetic insight that Freud had is still with us. And if there were nothing in that fraught mother-daughter relationship that Alice Sebold talks about, if there were nothing in it, the book wouldn't have sold a copy. Literature speaks to our anxieties. I think that's fair, and it works insofar as it plays off our shared anxieties. So I think that's the great value in Freud.
And the fact that so much literature really sort of takes the emotion of jealousy to its, you know, extremist conclusions, I suppose serves the function of making us feel a little bit better about our own feelings of jealousy, right? We're not going out and committing crimes and doing these horrible things and making scenes. We're just having these quiet feelings of discomfort.
I think that's the case, unless you strike a writer who talks about somebody feeling these quiet feelings of discomfort. Then you think, oh no, is this me? I don't mean me. I mean all of you.
Right.
I think that's George Smiley in John le Carré's spy books. It runs right through them, the jealousy he has of his philandering wife that he'll never express or speak to her about. He uses it as a symbol almost of the betrayal of Russia and Britain and Russia and the United States, the betrayal by his wife Anne of him. But it's a quiet jealousy. It's something he'd never act on. Strangely enough, in the end, if you read enough of those books, he actually gets back together with his wife, both in their dotage, and they live somewhere down Cornwall way. So it has a happy ending. So there's the two sorts.
Peter Tuohy is with us. He's professor of classics in the Department of Greek and Roman Studies at the University of Calgary and author of a new book called Jealousy. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Peter Tuohy, professor of classics in the Department of Greek and Roman Studies at the University of Calgary and author of the new book, Jealousy. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Bill who says, as a single middle-aged man who's been in and out of relationships all my life, I observe myself gazing upon other couples and other men's women and asking, why can't I have that? There have been rare occasions when I was with someone whom I felt had all the key qualities I need in a mate, both physical and otherwise. Can you comment on the grass is greener syndrome as it relates to relationships and what to do about that? Any thoughts, Peter?
I don't think I'm the person to turn to for what to do, but I could say that if you're feeling the grass is greener, then you're immune to jealousy, or the relationship is certainly not strong enough to produce jealousy. Because if you were attached in the way or so strongly that jealousy were a possibility, the grass would not seem greener anywhere else. So I think you're safe from today's topic, but I think you'd like to be a bit closer to it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Sean in Fort Worth. Hi, Sean.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call. I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. So this is a very interesting discussion, and I appreciate your honesty in just talking about this emotion, like you said, that seems to get kind of shoved under the rug. But from my take of it, it seems like your approach to understanding jealousy comes down to pragmatics and looking at it as something that we can harness for our own benefit. So, for example, you're talking about work and jealousy being something that can produce competition in us, which is great for capitalism and helps us to succeed at what we're doing. I wanted to kind of hear your perspective on my response as a Christian in seeing jealousy not as something that's pragmatic, but at the root of it reveals a deep idolatry of ourselves, making ourselves the center of the world. And the jealousy exposes that as, you know, we're not thinking of others, we're thinking of ourselves and how to further our own agenda.
What do you think, Peter?
I think it's a really important point, and there are two streams, and I don't want to get long-winded about it, but the evolutionary psychologists say that it's all about genetics, that what a person's attempting to do then is to replicate their genes, and in a sense the vessel, which is the human being, matters little. The gene simply pushes relentlessly to be replicated, so that for people like David Buss, who works in evolutionary psychology, he'd say at this point that the value of jealousy is that it increases your chances of replicating your genes. And that, in a sense, is the end of the story. Your genes will drive you to do anything. So that's not only a godless way of looking at things, but perhaps, though true to a point, is fairly reductive. The jealousy can work in a much more social way, and that it tends to work against this genetic interpretation that I've been suggesting to you. That this was a famous experiment done by Franz de Waal. He got two groups of Capuchin monkeys and a lab attendant. One group were fed, both groups of monkeys were fed cucumbers, then by the lab attendant. So there's the three people. Suddenly the lab attendant gave one group grapes, which apparently Capuchin monkeys prefer to cucumbers, which is understandable. And the reaction from the cucumber group was rage. And I think it was a righteous rage, in a sense, that the social covenant between the lab assistant and the two groups had been broken. So here, jealousy, the jealous anger of the monkeys for grapes too for us, is not selfishness, but rather equality of treatment. And this is something we haven't talked about, but how jealousy can be used to agitate for a level playing field amongst people. That it's, in a sense, there's no link to a personal idolatry here, which is the genetic line that I was speaking of, that would link with what you're saying. But here it's turning against the genes, because imagine a person who pushes too hard for his genes, and he's willing to bash up his wife who looks sideways at another man. Well, he may end up being killed by his wife's brothers, so much for his genes. But he's acted a bit like the chimp getting the grape. There has to be cooperation. That's maybe not quite the answer that you'd prefer, but it's a way a lot of people think about it, so that the idolatry of the self is balanced by the community needs, and jealousy helps in both ways.
And it does make sense that we look around, even within society, and say, okay, well, these people have access to jobs or to housing or to income that isn't available to me, and people are going to work for that, even though maybe we don't necessarily recognize that as jealousy because we have such negative associations with the emotion, but that's what it is. That's looking and saying, I want the same as someone else has.
Yes, and we feel particularly aggrieved if somebody has something that they haven't worked for. There's a game called the ultimatum game, and it's one psychologists use, so that people have to divvy up, let us imagine, $10, and they're going to be the stakes that you could use in a game or as part of the organization. Both players have to agree on the way it's divvied up, and they can keep the money at the end, but one player makes the decision. So he turns to the other partner and says, you can have $2 and I'm going to have $8. It's proved again and again that the person who's been offered the $2 says to the other person, well, I'm not going to be a part of this arrangement. And the other one will say, but that means I lose the $8 and you lose the $2, you get nothing. And the person will say, no, I don't care. It's not fair that things are not balanced out properly. Now, is that a jealous reaction? I would say it's on the spectrum of exactly what we're talking about. So jealousy here is used in a social setting that'll even hurt ourselves if we see an unfair situation being acted out. It's not exactly what you're saying, but it's showing how I think we use jealousy even to our own disadvantage to insist on fairness in social interactions.
You looked at friendship jealousy in the book as well, and it seems to manifest itself more in girls than boys or in a stronger way. And I was fascinated that it seems to peak in like fifth grade right before the transition to middle school, and then in 12th grade right before the transition to college or to, you know, life in the world of work.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I don't know the answer to that. Other than perhaps the anxieties related to it, that if you were to test that in countries that don't have middle high school and so on, like the one I came through with, it's just primary and secondary, it may work out differently, and you'd get a sense that it's the anxieties of shifting to a new level of schooling or the anxiety of moving out of schooling that may be behind the problem in this sort of friendship jealousy.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Julie on the line in Dallas. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, I was just curious if your guest, in preparing to write the book, looked at couples that participate in alternative lifestyles such as swinging. I know couples in those lifestyles typically, you know, report very few feelings of jealousy during, you know, sexual explorations, but, you know, also tend to have, you know, much more open, more honest relationships than particularly, you know, other couples that are more monogamous in their relationships.
And thank you so much for your call. Are they reporting less and feeling less, do you think, Peter? Or are they just reporting less?
There's a good book on this whole topic of polyamory. It's a sort of how-to thing written by a woman called Dolly Easton and Dossie Easton. And I like the book a lot, not because I have any inclinations in that direction, but it merely that it's utterly honest about people's motivations and how to make it work. And what she says of jealousy there is she says anyone who denies it in the polyamorous lifestyle is probably not telling the truth. She says it's one of the great problems that a person who is feels that this is the lifestyle for them has to deal with. And she says the best way through it, if polyamory is your persuasion, is to simply admit to it and try and work through it with your friends, with your partner. But she says in her experience it's aided most by absolute honesty and by putting all the cards on the table to start with. My feeling, however, from this is that the jealousy is just as big an issue for the polyamorous as it is for the rest of us, but it's something that they're willing to work through because of the demands of the lifestyle. That's what I've read.
It is interesting in polygamous relationships where people are sort of coming together to live together and not simply to have sexual adventures. There's very often like a ranking, right, among the spouses so that everyone kind of has a particular place to fill.
Yes, there's very little that I found to read about the feelings of people in these relationships. It's usually asserted that people are quite calm and happy about it, and I can't say yes or no. I did read one recent article that talked about often the neglect of the health of certain of the younger wives in these situations. This was in a particular country in North Africa, so it may be regional specific. So I don't know enough really to be able to say anything about a topic like that, other than that, as with polyamory, things shouldn't be taken at face value.
One major takeaway of this book for me was that we all experience jealousy, and for the most part, we all manage it pretty well. We all, you know, live with it and don't do anything too disruptive.
It seems to be the case, isn't it, that the George Smileys, the quietly jealous, the conscious cuckolds, you're not hearing about them in the newspapers or on television. So I guess we cope with it, and in most relationships, perhaps it never becomes an issue. I doubt that, really. I think it's omnipresent, but not always perhaps as strong. I guess we cope with it, and I think we'd probably cope a lot better if we were perhaps a little more open about it, both in our work lives and in our romantic lives. It's there for a reason, and it's not so much a matter of harnessing it, I think, as I think it was Steve suggested earlier, but rather living with it and understanding its inevitability and that we shouldn't feel ashamed of it.
Do you approve or disapprove of the old, like, storytelling plot device of trying to incite just a little bit of jealousy in someone you care about?
When the Japanese neurologist did the experiments with brains, he found that men's experience of jealousy was more visceral, women's was more cerebral. And if I'm being led into the most profound sexist statement at the minute, all I can say is I'm just reporting what was said in 2006, 2008. Women's experience seems to be profoundly different. It seems to be cerebral, that is to say, intelligent. Men's is muscular and emotional. So there can be a tendency for men to act it out, women to finagle with it according to these reports. So that, getting back to your question, that it's used consciously as a jealousy strengthener, if Takahashi's results were true, and I mean he used fMRIs and all that sort of thing to demonstrate it and show these different areas of the physical areas of the brain invoked in jealousy in men and women, it seems that the standard plot is actually pointing to some sort of basic truth.
Peter Tuohy is professor of classics in the Department of Greek and Roman Studies at the University of Calgary and author of the new book, Jealousy. Peter, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Mashal Noor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.